on my way down. I'm on my way down. Oh, you're not there yet. Awesome, because we're taping an intro to the podcast. We're taping an intro to the podcast. You're live on the air, Ann. You are on the air. Okay.
Hello, and welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff. I'm here with Aaron Lammer, who's waiting to get picked up. His ride's almost here.
I have a car here, waiting to go.
And Max Linsky.
No one ever picks me up.
Max, who did you talk to this week?
I talked to Jonathan Abrams, NBA features writer for Grantland. He does these big, long profiles of mostly young guys in the league. And seeing as how tomorrow is the NBA Finals, it seemed like a good excuse to talk to Jonathan Abrams.
If you need a good excuse to talk to people that you don't talk to that much, you might want to start an email newsletter, maybe with Tiny Letter from the good people at MailChimp. It's a simple, powerful way to send an email newsletter, and they are our sponsors, and we thank them. Here's Max and Jonathan Abrams.
Jonathan Abrams, thanks for trekking all the way to Dumbo.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Max.
I appreciate it. We are talking on Tuesday. The Miami Heat just won Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals. Finals start tomorrow, I guess, because this is running on a Wednesday. Do you have a prediction?
Yeah, I would be surprised if the Miami Heat didn't win another championship until you knock off the defending champions, and I think they always have a chance. Plus, they had the best player in the world. We saw that last night in Game 7.
Yeah, it didn't seem like he was going to let them lose.
No, not at all. And then you had Dwayne Wade suddenly come back to life out of the fucking woodworks. And right.
Dwayne Wade, all of a sudden, Dwayne Wade again.
Yeah, all of a sudden he got his knees back right. In between Game 6 and 7.
John, I wanted to have you on because I've been a real fan of these long profiles you've been doing for Grantland. And it might be helpful maybe for anyone who's listening who doesn't know your work for you to sort of explain what you do there.
Yeah. Well, I specialize in long form, mostly basketball profiles. I've done a few other features, a few oral histories where, it's one quote after another of people involved in big NBA basketball events. The biggest one is probably the Malice at the Palace.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
But yeah, it's basically, profiles, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 words, probably more than anybody would want to read about Steven Jackson, but throw it all together and call it a piece. And
what kind of stories are you looking for?
It's not one particular one. I talked to Bill Simmons about it. I talked to my editor, Sean Fennessy, about it. And we just kind of try to find guys with interesting backgrounds, maybe guys who are either misunderstood or not explained fully. And we try to go after guys like that.
Yeah, it seems like, you've written about Steven Jackson and Ricky Davis and Lance Stevenson. It seems like you're kind of drawn to players who have interesting backgrounds, but also have been totally typecast, like that have huge reputations, often not very good ones.
Yeah, and my whole thought going into that is these guys have these reputations. Maybe they're accurate and maybe they're not. But I just try to explain why they are the way that they are. That's my whole goal in the profiles, is trying to explain how they got to be this way, and whether it's, reality or not with these guys.
I feel like that goal in and of itself is different than most sports writing, but part of the reason that most sports writers don't go out to try and sort of really explain an athlete is because athletes are so buttoned up. There's all those jokes about those halftime interviews, and you can't get anyone to say anything that's not a cliche. How do you get these guys to open up? You can't tell their story without them telling it to you, right? So how do you get that out of them?
Right. There's different ways to go about it. One thing that's been good for me is that I've covered the league probably 6 or 7 years now. I started out at the Los Angeles Times and then moved on to the New York Times. So hopefully my face is familiar to most of these guys by now. I have good relationships with a lot of agents, a lot of team PR people who will help me out if I say, hey, you know, can I get Steven Jackson for a while in a one-on-one setting? You know, more times than not, they're going to help me out because people know that the stories that I try to do, I'm not trying to burn anybody. I'm trying to tell a story for what it's worth and be honest to that person. And I think that helps out.
So you've got like a reputation. You do enough of these stories and then you call and people are like, oh, I'm going to get the Abrams treatment.
That's happened a couple times, but I mean, it's not that easy. It would be, you know, if you saw like the list of people like between Bill Simmons and Sean, my editor, who we like wanted to write about, and they're like, no, you know, it's a pretty extensive list.
can you tell me anyone who's on that list?
There's a good number. Tracy McGrady is one right now. He's not doing much for San Antonio, right? But Allen Iverson, I try to reach out to him. But there's a lot. There may be like a one in like five chance that people would actually want to do a story, because you're asking somebody to tell their life story. I mean, it's a lot, you know, and that person has to trust you. And even there's been some times when I'll get a person only for like 10 minutes, but then I'll build that story around people who are close to that person who will be more enlightening to tell me about that person. Because most of the time when you talk to somebody, they're not going to, you know, be open about it, or they're going to want to portray themselves in the best way possible, where that's not the story you want, right? You want an honest story. You don't want to make it worse. You don't want to make it better. You want an honest story. And you want the people you interview to be able to tell you, you know, what's right, rather than inflate stuff. So that's really what I go for.
How do you get these guys to feel comfortable with you? And are there certain sort of questions that you ask everyone? Are there ways you get people to loosen up? Is it different for different guys? Like, how do you approach it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different for different guys. Whenever I settle on a profile subject, the first thing I do is print out everything I can find that's been written on that person, so I feel like I know that person inside and out. The second thing I'll do is I'll try to call and track down as many people as I can to talk to that person about, you know, their high school coach, high school teammates, family, college coaches, college teammates, everybody I can who's been a part of that road and part of that journey for that particular player. So I try to come into the interviews as knowledgeable about that person as possible. Most of the time I'll write down maybe like 25 questions that I want to ask a person. I don't, you know, sit there and read from a notepad questions, but I just have those in the back of my head in case we ever get stuck. And then I just go from there. One of the questions I always ask anybody is, do you wish that I'd asked you anything? Because that's usually a question that gets one of the better answers, because, you know, if I was being interviewed and if I really wanted to talk about something, but the interviewer never asked me about it, I'd be kind of bummed about it. So, you know, that also helps that person think, because usually they don't get that question, and it makes them think about what they really want to say and how they want the story to be portrayed.
I'll make sure I ask you that at the end, but I'm not going to ask you that. How old are you?
I'm 29.
Do you think that having those kinds of relationships with the people you're writing about who are also in their 20s is going to change as you get older?
I know it will, but you know, it's certainly to my advantage that a lot of these guys are age-wise my peers. You know, I started covering the league when I was 23, and I remember I was a beat writer for the Clippers for the Los Angeles Times, and their rookie at that time, Al Thornton, was my age. And it felt like we were both rookies at the same time, and we became, you know, real good friends with each other. In fact, like, I still call his mom just to ask her how she's doing every once in a while. You know, and I can talk to these guys about, you know, music or other stuff. And, you know, it probably doesn't come across on this podcast, but I am black. So I look like a lot of these guys as well. And, you know, I don't think that hurts me at all.
Have you become friends with any of these guys that you've written about after the fact?
Not really, because
you're not hanging out with J.R. Smith.
Yeah, exactly.
Seems like so much fun.
Me and Riri, J.R. Nah, it. You know, I've always tried to keep it professional, not be friends with these guys. You know, I will say, Elton Brand is a really really good professional guy. He's the only NBA player who will like email out of the blue and ask how you're doing and stuff like that. So, I mean, I do, you know, there's nobody I really consider a friend, but I think Elton is pretty close.
Who do you think of? So you're writing, you know, whatever it is, 7,000 words about Steven Jackson. Who's your audience? Who are you like? Who are you writing for?
I guess it would be the basketball fanatic, you know. It's my wife, she works for the New York Times, and she does an education blog, and she was talking about target audience, and this was just a couple days ago, and I thought about it. I was like, you know what? I don't even know who my target audience is, you know. I guess it would have to be basketball fanatics to read that much about, you know, not even a guy who hasn't even been an all-star once, a guy who's most known for shooting his gun in the air at a strip club.
But I mean, you know, when I want to watch a game on the weekends, and occasionally my wife is not like, that's not like her like number one activity. If I can like tell her the story, like the backstory of the teams or one of the guys or whatever, if I can like get her hooked on like the emotional aspect of it, she'll like sit and watch with me and be super into it. And I feel like that's kind of like what you're doing in these stories a little bit, like. You have to have some sort of basketball IQ, I think, to get it. But it seems like you're trying to get at something beyond that with these guys.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, my stories will help you know these guys better. And that's you know, one of my main goals is that you know why this person is this way. When they step on the court, you know why Monte Ellis is going to keep shooting the ball, or... you know why Zach Randolph is such a gritty player, because I think, you know, the backgrounds and what these guys have gone through growing up, you know, it materializes in their game, I think.
Are they, I mean, there's, you know, going to be differences from guy to guy, but are they introspective? Like when are these, this like line of questioning when you're getting people to like talk about their childhoods and, you know, talk about like their fears and stuff like that. Like, are they surprised by the questions? Are they like facile with that conversation?
I don't think so, because I think I try to like lead them there where I want to go in steps, you know, so I don't sit down and ask them, you know, ask Steven Jackson, hey, so tell me about that strip club incident. You know, that's not the number one question. So I think they are introspective. You know, Zach Randolph, he was one of the most introspective interviews I did, because he was talking about, he has a 14-year-old son, and he's talking about, you know, that age, how impressionable they are and how impressionable he was at that age. And he was, you know, really, really, you know, talking about growing up and, you know, how rough he had it and without his dad and growing up in a place that was, you know, racist at points. And, you know, he grew up in Marion, Indiana, and they had, I think that was the last place of the lynching in the United States. Of a public lynching, and that, you know, really is seared into his brain. So, you know, the way people grew up is, it really affects who they are today, obviously. And that's what I try to pull out. You know, I want people to be able to read my stories and be able to find out, you know, not just one thing new about somebody, but several different new things.
How did Randolph respond to that story once it came out?
It was actually funny, because I try to wait until I can see the guys in person again. I don't try to call, so they can, if they have beef with me, they can, you know, say it to my face. And, you know, Zach was like, you know, I like that story, Jonathan. I really like that story. I just thought it was a little too negative. He was like, you know, there was like maybe like 30% positive and 70% negative. I wish it was like even some more. And, you know, I told Zach, you know, I try to, you know, I try to talk to him about how, you know, oh, I'm sorry you felt it was that way. You know, I try to really portray everything evenly and honestly. And then after the game, he pulled me aside again just to tell me that, hey, I'm not mad at you. I just want you to know, you know, everything's cool with us. You know, I don't want you to get the wrong idea. You know, he's a good guy.
Have other people not handled it quite so graciously?
No, I think everybody is... has responded pretty well. Royce White and Chauncey Billups and Steven Jackson were happy with the stories that I did on them. You know, J.R. Smith, I asked him a few weeks later what he thought of the story, and he was like, what story?
Yeah, that's great. All right, well, tell us a little bit about your story, man. How did you end up doing this?
Well, I mean, I grew up in Southern California, loving sports, and grew up loving reading newspapers. You know, I was one of those families where my dad had the paper in front of him first thing every morning. So, you know, once my athletic career, I knew that didn't pan out in high school. That was pretty obvious. I knew that I wanted to go into journalism and kind of combine those two loves. So I went to USC and majored in print journalism.
Print journalism.
How old are you? I don't even know if they still have that around.
If they still have that around, man, that's like someone should do that just as a gag. Wait, so you were like, I'm not interested in digital journalism.
At that time,
I only want to work on printed matter.
Yeah, at that time it was viable, and I remember at USC when I was a freshman, that was the first year they had like these core classes, so you could major in print, major in broadcast, but you would still have to take some broadcast classes or some online journalism classes at that same time, and they were still trying to figure it out.
All right, so you majored in print journalism, and then you went and got a print journalism job?
I did. You know, this was, you know, 2001, 2002, so, you know, newspapers were still rolling.
Yeah, I had one year in 2004 where I was working for a newspaper, and it felt like, in hindsight, it was like the last good year.
It probably was. You know, it's funny because I did this like big, I did a summer internship at the LA Times after I graduated college, and that was in sports. And then I decided that I wanted kind of a fuller journalism background, so I did this like college program of recent graduates where it was 10 of us from all these good schools, you know, Harvard, Stanford, who wanted to go into journalism. And it was a program ran by Tribune called MetPro. So all of us basically intern at the LA Times for a year in different sections, and we moved around a bit and we wrote for the paper. And then at the end of it, they have like this draft where it's the most stressful thing ever. There's 10 of you, right? And all of these papers like get to draft one journalist. So you could be staying at the LA Times or going to the Chicago Tribune or going to like Allentown or Stanford or Newport News, Virginia. So it was a really, really big discrepancy, and it was, you know, stressful.
Did they like announce it in order?
No, I forgot how they just brought people back and you like met with your newspaper. It was like, you know, meeting your new foster parents.
Right.
I ended up staying at the Los Angeles Times.
Oh, good deal.
Yeah, I was like, and I
did you just taunt the other nine?
No, because it was my future wife was one of them. But she's from Florida, and she went to the Orlando Sentinel, so it was a good deal for her too.
Right on. All right, so you landed at the LA Times and started covering the Clippers?
Well, for a year I worked in a bureau in Riverside, covering all types of like crazy court cases, because it's all the desert and crazy people out there and, you know, wildfires and stuff, good stuff like that. So I did that for a year, and then they put me on the Clipper beat because I wanted to go back into sports.
And how long did you do that for?
Just a year before I came over to the New York Times.
Traveling with the team and everything?
Yeah. Well, you know, in the NBA, it's stressful because you're always chasing the team. So the team leaves after a night game, and you have to spend the night in that city, and then you have to take the first flight out and try to catch up to them. It's not a sustainable life.
Yeah, it seems like a good job for a 23-year-old. Although, I mean, there are a bunch of guys who have tried to make it a sustainable life. I mean, people have been doing this for years and years.
Yeah.
Were you like accepted into the like, you know, beat writer fraternity?
Yeah, I mean, that's the one thing. I could say more than one thing, but that's a really big thing about NBA writers, is that it really feels like it's a, you know, fraternity, sorority, whatever, where I can, you know, have so many friends and I can call up so many different people for anything. If I need a number, if I need, you know, anything. A lot of them got invited to my wedding just because, you know, it's competitive and everything, but people know where to draw the lines and people are friends for life.
So you spent a year doing the Clippers and then you went to the Times. How is it different sort of, I mean, how is covering basketball in New York different than covering basketball in L.A.?
You know, it wasn't all that different, to be honest with you. And I was expecting a huge difference. I was expecting these crazy, psycho, aggressive New York reporters and me, this laid-back Southern California kid, to get eaten up. And I was really nervous and really, you know, thinking about the change. But, of course, my wife was, well, girlfriend at the time was moving to New York for grad school to go to NYU. So that made the change a lot easier and more acceptable. But I mean, I was scared for a while. But, you know, you just deal with some of the random craziness of the tabloids and know that, you know, most of what they do is going to be entertaining above all else. And you just go with that. You know, Howard Beck at the Times, who still their resident basketball writer, was really, really good mentor for me. And he's a great, great writer. So he was really good to learn from. I told Howard, I feel like he's too smart to be a journalist. Like he's wasting his talents when he should be, you know, like a scientist or something. He's just, like, the best compliment I feel like I gave him is it feels like every single word he writes like was meant to be there. And when you're doing that on deadline on a really consistent basis, it's just amazing. So, you know, with him, I think I learned a lot about how to be a professional, how to write on deadline, because in New York, you know, you go out west from New York and the deadlines get rougher, right? Because of the time difference.
Right.
If you're writing for a Los Angeles paper and you go out east, you get more time. So it's, you know, going from Los Angeles to New York and having to write game stories, you know, have 95% of it done before the game ends, you know, and a last second shot could change who actually wins the game. You know, Howard could do that. I felt like I never completely mastered that, but I certainly got better having watched Howard do it.
So you're writing for LA Times, come to the New York Times, you're writing these game reports, you're doing daily journalism, you're writing on deadline, and then all of a sudden you land at Grantland and you start writing 7,000 word stories. How did that happen?
It's actually funny because I had never met Bill Simmons. You know, I didn't think he knew who I was. And I was remember that Lakers series a couple years ago when the Lakers just got throttled by the Mavericks?
Yeah.
The Mavericks. I was at Staples Center covering the game for the Times, and J.A. Adonde of ESPN, who I'm friends with, just came up to me and said, "Hey, Bill Simmons is looking for you." And I said, "Oh, okay." You know, I didn't know what it was about. And we went over and found Bill, and Bill introduced himself. You know, he told me a little bit about Grantland, and Grantland hadn't come out yet. It was still a few months away from debuting. But he asked me what type of journalism I was interested in doing. And I said, you know, eventually I want to try to do long form because that's the type of journalism that I like reading the most. And, you know, I would really like to see, you know, what I can do if I have time to actually ingest what I see, you know, rather than write on deadline every night and just hope that it makes sense when you send it off. And, you know, we talked, and then the next day I came in and I met with the Bill and Dan Fairman, who's a managing editor, and Jay Caspian King, who is a alumni of this podcast. And I mean, I got a really, really good vibe from it all. And it was still really, really tough to leave the New York Times because the Times was really, really good paper, really good to me. I made a lot of friends.
It's also the New York Times.
It's also the New York fucking Times. You know, leaving it for a website that it's backed by ESPN, but at the same time, it's something that doesn't exist yet. You know, it's going to be Bill Simmons. It's going to be ESPN. You know, it's going to be good, but putting that up against the New York fucking Times, it's still a close call. You know, it was like 51-49.
Yeah, did it take you a while to make the decision?
It did. It did, to the point where Bill was like, "I'm starting to get worried." But I think I just emailed Bill and John Walsh from ESPN. I think I just sent like three word email, like, "I'm in." And that was it.
You know, what tipped it?
There was a few things. It was the chance to be able to do long form journalism, the chance to eventually move back to California, which is where I would want to live. Those were the two biggest things. And you know, I didn't know it at the time, but working with Bill has been great. Bill is an incredible guy. You know, you can bounce ideas off of him. he's read a lot of my stories and given suggestions and honestly edited them before I, you know, they run. I feel like there's like seven Bill Simmons running around. Like,
how is, you know, for a print journalism major, how's it been different writing for the internet?
I mean, there's the only difference is, you know, you can't even, but I was about to say you can't pick up what you do and you know, read it. But, you know, even with Grantland, we print out the Grantland Quarterly. So I guess you can. So, you know, honestly, there hasn't been much of a difference because even with newspapers, so much of the emphasis was going toward online anyways, where you could have longer stories online or you could do write throughs. That would be online and that would be the better story, but you just didn't have time to do that good of a story for the paper. So you would know, you would take comfort in knowing that at least it was online and better than the ramble that you sent in for the newspaper that had to be cut off because of deadline. So, I mean, I think that's the two biggest things is like length. I can obviously write a lot longer and there's no deadline. So I have no excuse for stories not to be good.
Even on the internet, most people still have a deadline. How do you, without having that like kind of firm deadline, how do you get the stuff done? Like, how do you keep yourself going?
You know, it's, I think I'm a motivated person where I want to see myself do well and I want to keep getting better. If I wasn't wired that way, then it would be a real big problem, especially because I live in New York and Grantland is based in Los Angeles. So, you know, it would be pretty easy to slack off.
This podcast kind of modeled on WTF, if you're listening to that Marc Maron podcast.
Yeah, Jay wrote about him.
And part of the thing that guy's been doing it for like years, or I don't know how long he's been doing it. He's done hundreds of episodes, right? And like his thing is also like he kind of gets into it, like starts talking about your childhood and like, you know, he kind of goes for like the soft underbelly of people. And I've gotten this sense now that when I'm listening to it, like people are coming on prepared. So either they like walk in and they're like, I'm not going to let you go there with me, or they like have their like sob story lined up, you know, and always like almost like feels rehearsed. Do you worry at all that like people are going to start knowing they're getting that treatment from you and kind of like tailor the story a little bit? Like, can you continue to get guys to be that open with you, or is it at some point like, is that going to get harder to do?
I know, it's a good question. You know, I don't think that there's any lack of compelling NBA stories or NBA personalities. I mean, I think I can keep going and going. And you know, I really wanted to do a story on Chris Anderson for these playoffs. Chris was another guy who said no, where I think
he's got a crazy backstory.
Yeah, I think I could have really, really did a good story on him. But as it turns out, I went down to Miami and I have a story on Chris Bosh that's, I think it'll be up. I think Thursday, I think we decided we were going to run it because I was sweating bullets that they were going to win yesterday. So that story would still would still go up. But yeah, I mean, I think people have different stories, you know. If it gets too tough, I can, you know, switch sports or something.
Right. Are there non-basketball things that you want to write about?
There are. You know, the funny thing was that I thought when I was coming to Grantland that I was going to do different sports, but I just got into a routine and a rhythm of doing NBA. You know, that's what I'm comfortable with. That's the sport that I love. That's a sport that Bill Simmons obviously loves. So I guess we just fell into that pattern. But I think I'm going to do basketball for the foreseeable future. I mean, cause I'm also working on a book right now about the NBA's whole high school to NBA generation of players. So I think that'll really, you know, take up a lot of reporting time too.
Yeah, for sure. When's that book supposed to come out?
January 2015 is when the manuscript's due, so I have a little bit of time.
Man, how do you even tackle a project like that? Like, are you like working on it every day?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, already. I'm trying to work on it every day. I mean, I have a, you know, obviously with the book proposal, I had to do an outline of all the chapters and, you know, it's going to be a shitload of interviews. It's already been a shitload of interviews. And, you know, at some point I'm going to have to sort everything out. Right now I'm in a, I guess, gather mode where right. I'm just trying to get as much stuff as I can.
Do you have like a general thesis though?
Yeah. I mean, the whole, you know, one and done rule to me is ridiculous. And, you know, to me, I think a lot of these guys were victims, you know, really eaten up and spit out by the system. You know, a lot of them were successful, but the guys who weren't failed pretty spectacularly. And I think the system should have been set up better to protect them from outside influences, say runners, agents, family, aggressive family members who wanted to capitalize, those type of things.
What would be a better system than one and done?
Well, for one, I feel like there shouldn't be a one and done rule. Guys should be able to go straight to the NBA if they're ready, you know, and it should be the team and the executives to be able to decide, you know, if they're ready or not. And then if they're not ready and if they decide for the NBA, you know, why shouldn't they be able to go to college even if they declare? You know, why should that be a forfeiting of their eligibility? I mean, it makes no sense. These amateur rules.
Right. I mean, especially when you see like injuries like Noel and, you know, I mean, it just seems like you're just putting these kids at risk.
Yeah, don't steal any of my chapters.
Probably the most famous story you've written so far for Grantland was this oral history of the Malice at the Palace when Ron Artest went in the stands.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you could for anyone who's listening, I don't know how many sports fans we have listening to the podcast, so maybe you could just kind of like give the backstory of that.
So this happened in late 2004. The Pistons and the Pacers played each other in Detroit, and there was a lot of bad blood stemming from a tough playoff series these teams went through the previous year. And, you know, basically toward the end of the game, Ben Wallace and Ron Artest got into it. Ben Wallace kept escalating the situation. Ron Artest went and laid down on the scorer's table. And then a fan threw a cup that splashed onto Artest, and all hell broke loose. You know, Artest, long before he was Metal World Peace and found his zen, ran into the stands and, you know, tried to go after the fan. I think he went after a wrong one. The Pacers, several of them, threw punches at fans. You know, Steven Jackson ran up there, started throwing punches at anybody and everybody. Jonathan Bender tried to lean way back and throw a haymaker at a fan, but he luckily slipped. Or else a bunch of people thought he would have, you know, really, really did a lot of damage to that guy. And, you know, fans, the Pacers were trying to exit the court, and fans were throwing debris and even chairs onto the court. It really quickly went from a fight between the Pacers and the Pistons to a fight between the Pacers and the fans of the Pistons.
It's this incredibly bleak night. And, I kind of, like, remember when it happened, but rereading your story, and when I read it for the first time, it's like you forget how wild it was. Like, you forget how, like, the air in there, and hearing the guys who are on the court and the guys who are involved talk about it, like, they still seem shook up about it.
Oh, without a doubt. I think Jermaine O'Neal was really obviously still bothered by it, and how it just about ended his relationship in Indianapolis with that team and that franchise, where, you know, he told me everybody needed a fresh start after that. And, you know, Steven Jackson as well. You know, Steven Jackson was complaining, saying, you know, to this day, Ron Artest hasn't thanked him for having his back and running up into the stands with him, because, you know, Steven Jackson was worried about Ron Artest's well-being more than anything else. You know, that's what he said. Right. I don't know if throwing punches wildly is the answer to that, but...
How hard did you try and get Artest?
Very. there are a few people who wouldn't talk to me for that story, because, you know, even though it was 7 or 8 years later, it was still fresh in their minds, and Artest was one of those people. You know, I tried several times through the Lakers PR, and the Lakers PR guy, John Black, tried to get Ron to talk to me for it, but Ron just didn't have it. And then I tried to get him when the Lakers played here that year against the Knicks, and he wouldn't talk to me about it. It's actually funny, because it was really, really hard to talk to people about this at the beginning. And the Bucks played the Knicks here, and Steven Jackson was still on the Bucks then. And I had maybe talked to Steven Jackson once, and it was one question, two sentence answer, and he was suspended for that night's game because I went down to talk to him or to try to talk to him at shoot around, but he missed shoot around, so he got suspended for that night's game. So then I came to the game that night, and I talked to the Milwaukee Bucks PR guy. His name is Dan. And I was like, you think I can still get Steven? You think he would still talk about this? And Dan's like, well, let me see. Hold on. Stand in this room next to the locker room. So I'm standing in this room, and all of a sudden I hear Steven's voice saying, oh, man, I love talking about the brawl. I love talking about the brawl. And I thought, oh, man, he's just being facetious about it. He doesn't want to talk about it at all. No, it was a complete opposite. He had been waiting to talk about it for a while, and he talked about it for 45 minutes or an hour, to the point where the game was getting ready to start and I had to get out of there. But it was, and that's what made the story go from there. Other people didn't want Steven Jackson's memory to be there to stand up for them,
Steven Jackson could not be the entire record of the
house. Yeah. So then the next one was, the next key one to get was Jermaine O'Neal. And Jermaine was like the last, I think he was the last interview I did. And he had said no a few times, but I still got the impression that maybe he would be willing to talk. So I kept coming after him, even to the point where I showed him one of the drafts, without him in it, and then he finally agreed to do it, and then he said he forgot about it. So then I had to go up all the way to Boston to get him again, and then he finally did it on the phone and talked about it. And I think it was good for him, because he had a lot of key quotes, and he apologized to Indianapolis and the city for what that fight did to it.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like he just had tremendous regrets, and you got the impression, I'm not sort of not surprised to hear that, you got the impression like he hadn't said a lot of that stuff out loud, kind of.
Yeah.
Was the goal from the start to do it as an oral history?
Yeah, it was. It would have been tough to do that as a straight story. I think, oral histories, I think they can get gimmicky, I guess, if you do them too much.
Yeah, I wouldn't say they've got like a great rep at this point.
Yeah.
Oral history.
Well, yeah, there's been a few that I'm like shake my head at. They don't have to be, why not just write the story?
Right.
I think any oral history, I think it needs, a lot of conflict, a lot of, sex, drugs and things like that, and violence. I think it has to be almost like a movie that you're reading. And I think, the Malice at the Palace oral history, I think, had that.
Are they easier, oral histories? Are they easier to do?
No, I don't think so. Because if I was, writing a story and if I needed to transition, I could write that transition. On this, you're relying on your whole interview power. You need people to build the scenes, to make the scenes, to create the controversy, to be able to transition through the voices, for everything to be linear and everything to make sense, and for you to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. They're a lot tougher to me.
Do you end up like getting the basic? I mean, how do you approach an oral history? Maybe take us through like the process. Like, do you have an outline? You're trying to fill holes. How's it work?
You just try to talk to everybody you can that was involved. It's not that much different from how you start off, or how I start off doing a regular story. You try to do that, and then you just try to pile up the best quotes, and then from there it's almost like you're a director trying to put together the scenes and the voices.
What was the reaction to that Malice in the Palace story?
I think
from the players and from the league, and
I think it was good. I think it helped. There was obviously some of why now, or why are you revisiting this now, because it wasn't like it was a anniversary or anything, but I think talking about it and the NBA not running away from it was a little bit, therapeutic. Just now I feel like you can completely put that behind them.
All right. So your prediction is Heat are going to beat the Spurs. And then what does an NBA writer do in the offseason?
This one works on his book. I mean, there's, offseason is such a a funny term because there really is none now. You go from, you know, the finals to the draft to free agency to summer league to, you know, you're lucky if you get a couple weeks off, you know, for the beat writers.
So it seems like it's time. What haven't I asked you?
What haven't you asked me? You know what? You're a pretty good interviewer. You know, we talked about...
That's a bullshit dodge.
You know, that's the response I've gotten so far from some players. That's the response I like the most.
Jonathan, thanks so much for coming in, man.
It was a pleasure, Max.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Evan Ratliff and Aaron Lemmer. Our editor is Lauren Kirchner. Our episode this week was sponsored by Tiny Letter. Thanks very much to Jonathan Abrams for coming in. We'll be back next week.